This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Volkswagen Beetle may have the strangest history of any car. It was designed in response to Adolf Hitler's demand for an affordable car for the German people. 30 years later, after it caught on in the U.S., the Beetle became the affordable car of the hippie counterculture. By the 80s, the VW Bug had been overtaken by compact Japanese cars, but the Beetle's design was so popular it was revived in the 90s with a new retro model that came in candy-colored designs. My guest, Phil Patton, is the author of the new book, Bug, The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. He writes regularly for the New York Times Design Notebook, Public Eye, and Automotive columns. He was a consulting curator for the Museum of Modern Art's 1999 exhibition on automobiles for the new century. I asked Patton about Hitler's connection to the Beetle.
Hitler really was the man who made the Volkswagen happen. The idea of a people's car had been around in Germany for many years, and there were advocates for it. But the very first thing Hitler did after coming to power as chancellor in January of 1933 was to declare he was going to help the automobile industry build highways and build a car for the masses. This, of course, was quite popular, and the vision of American prosperity danced in the minds of Germans, and it was something he wanted to exploit.
Does Volkswagen translate from people's car?
Volkswagen literally means people's car, and it was really a generic name before it became a trademark. There had been talk of a people's car in Germany back in the 20s, and there were even models of cars from other manufacturers called people's cars or Volkswagen, well before the actual Nazi model appeared.
Why was building cars and building roads so important for Hitler's plan?
It's important to remember that Hitler's grasp on power was a bit tenuous when he first became chancellor. And with unemployment high, building highways was an excellent way to create jobs. And helping the automobile industry was, in a modern industrial economy, a way to pump up the economy. In fact, a lot of economists believe that it did more to restore the German economy than rearmament actually did. So he was fairly shrewd in both creating economic stimulus and propaganda appeal.
Now, was the development of cars and highways linked in Hitler's mind to militarization?
William Shirer and other historians have depicted the Volkswagen as pretty much just a propaganda ploy, but it really was quite closely woven into Hitler's own vision. He saw the Autobahns extending into the conquered territories in the East, and he even measured out the map of these conquered territories according to how far a Volkswagen could go in a day. He ordered that villages be built for the new German farmers he was going to install there, and there would be a town with an inn, a Volkswagen's drive apart from each of the other towns.
Now, Hitler asked Porsche to design the car. I always thought that Porsche was the founder of the Porsche and never associated him with designing the humble VW Bug.
Well, it's funny. Ferdinand Porsche was a major public figure in Europe. He was a hero engineer who had even worked for the Kaiser in the First World War. And he was well known, having worked designing racing cars and other cars for Mercedes and other companies. And he had been pushing a people's car, too. Like Hitler, he was a guy from the provinces, and he had a notion of bringing a fairly inexpensive, good car back to the sort of rural folk from whom he sprang. So they had an interesting relationship. Porsche didn't have much interest in ideology, but he had a kind of almost avuncular relationship with Hitler, and the two of them got along in a very strange and weird way.
How did the Bug get its shape?
The Bug got its shape from some of the ideas about streamlining of the period. The airflow in other cars had been appearing. As speeds got higher, the engineers were looking to reduce drag. But Hitler was very interested in specifically getting involved. He fancied himself an automotive expert, and he instructed Porsche to look to nature for the shapes of streamlining, and specifically told him, look to the Beetle, lending this nickname almost immediately. And Hitler made also, it appears, a number of drawings suggesting the shape, and you can be sure that Dr. Porsche hastened to round the front in just the manner that Hitler had suggested.
While the VW bug was being built, Hitler gave it a different name. He called it the KDF wagon. What does that name mean? What was the significance of that name?
Hitler wanted the car called the Strength Through Joy wagon. That was the organization, Strength Through Joy, a propaganda organization that organized recreational activities for workers to boost their morale. And one of the things that they had were savings plans. You could save for a ski vacation or a cruise. Finally, it was hit upon that workers could save a few marks each week and buy the car in this manner.
But you say even when it was officially being called the KDF wagon, the logo that was coming off of the assembly line and being put on the car was the VW logo. How did that happen?
There was a KDF logo, which was partly derived from the swastika, but there was a lot of public skepticism toward all the Nazi propaganda, and most people really referred to it still as the Volkswagen. The name had simply been established for so long.
Toward the end of World War II, slave labor was used at the VW production plant. And you say the people from occupied countries in Eastern Europe and in Europe were kind of enslaved to work in this plant. People were taken out of Auschwitz to work in the plant. Describe what you know of what working conditions were like at that point in time at the VW plant in Germany.
Slave labor of all types was used, including, first of all, Soviet prisoners of war. Prisoners of war, of course, are not supposed to be impressed into labor under the Geneva Convention, but they were. People who were pulled out of occupied France as political opponents. People who were brought from Poland and other conquered territories in the East, including women. And at one point, skilled Jewish metal workers brought from concentration camps. And absurdly, each of these different types of laborer was given a different food ration, different uniform, different privileges within the plant, where a variety of wartime activities were going on in addition to simply building military vehicles. Bombs, artillery shells, all sorts of things were built in this vast factory that had been planned to turn out millions of cars.
Did VW ever offer any public apology for using slave labor and people from the concentration camps?
VW was in the 1990s one of the most forward of the German companies, and most major German companies had used the slave labor in trying to come to terms with this under their CEO, Karl Hahn. Hahn commissioned an 800-page book by the eminent German historian Hans Mommsen and a team of historians working for him to come to a full accounting of those years. And what is amazing is how much documentation there was, both office papers, photographs, things that survived. Volkswagen also established a fund to compensate surviving slave laborers well before there was a national fund established by the German government. And then they began to turn their back a little bit when Ferdinand Piëch became CEO. Piëch's father had been the head of the factory during the war. Piëch's grandfather was Ferdinand Porsche, and he felt that that in many ways the accounting of the slave labor years, the whole Nazi experience, had been aimed at embarrassing him, and he refused to have the book translated into other languages.
My guest is Phil Patton, author of the new book, Bug, The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the history of the Volkswagen Beetle. My guest, Phil Patton, is the author of the new book, Bug, The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile. When the Volkswagen was exported to the United States, the image of the car, I think, really started to change. For a lot of Jewish people in the United States, it was a car associated with the Nazis, and they didn't want to go near it. And I'm sure a lot of other Americans had similar misgivings about this car. What was done to change the image of the Volkswagen Beetle from Hitler's car to a fun, cheap, small car that Americans would enjoy?
Well, a few GIs had brought Volkswagens back from Europe, and there were a few imported. But it really took a growing sense of the Beetle as a product of West Germany, not of greater Hitler Germany, and also an ad campaign by the late 1950s, ironically, as with so many things in the Beetle story, by a Jewish ad agency. These were probably the most famous ads of the century, and the campaign was voted the best ad campaign in a number of century-end surveys. The Think Small ads, the Lemon ads, which talked about the single strip of chrome disqualifying a Volkswagen from being shipped over, all these turned on the German image for high technology, because frightening as they were in a military way, we knew their technology was good. We knew their rocket scientists were helping us put satellites in orbit in the late 50s. And also, there was a sense that the ad agency moved to Americanize the car. That was their initial goal. And they did that by latching on to an existing set of American values. Detroit was advertising its cars on the basis of such American values as flash and size and power and speed. But the ad agency for Volkswagen went back to American virtues such as frugality, economy, the characteristics of the Model T or the covered wagon. And probably the best advertisement that summed this up was the one they did around the time of the moon landing that showed the lunar lander, which was itself called Bug, with the line, "It's ugly, but it gets you there." And all those American virtues of can-do, do-it-yourself, plainness were soon to be reflected in the Beetle.
The Beetle caught on for a lot of young college people, and then it became a really big car in the hippie counterculture of the 60s. What do you think accounts for that? Do you think it's because it was cheap, or do you think that there was something else at work there?
Part of the Beetle's appeal was first in academic towns, and I grew up in a college town where I remember seeing Beetles along with, you know, the odd Italian and British sports car. But it was not the people who bought the people's car in the United States, not the workers and farmers, but intellectuals and people who appreciated it by contrast with the big chrome tail fin Detroit vehicles. And it was very much a kind of reverse snobism to make a statement with that kind of vehicle. Later, as the 60s went on, there was a baby boom in progress. A lot of teenagers had a Beetle as their first car because it was an economical vehicle to add to the family garage.
I remember in the 60s, there were a lot of Jewish families in which buying a Volkswagen was a very controversial act. You know, the newly adult kid wanted a Volkswagen because it was a cheap car and it was, you know, a kind of hip car to have. And the parents often felt like you shouldn't give them your money because this was a car associated with Hitler and the Nazis. How could you buy it? Do you remember those debates?
I remember those debates not only about Volkswagen, and they're completely understandable, but about Mercedes. And that was the feeling of people like George Lois, who worked at the ad agency producing the Volkswagen ads. There was a great deal of ambivalence on the part of the ad agency about working with a car that he said still reminded you of the ovens. You know, how would they deal with that issue?
Do you think that link between Volkswagen and Hitler still exists in the minds of many American consumers? Do you think that that's that there are many people now who would not buy that car because of its roots in the Reich.
What surprises me, particularly with the new Beetle and particularly with people in their 20s and younger, is in many cases an absence of awareness even of the old Beetle. It's something they see in movies, and it's a distant memory, but they don't associate it. They don't even associate the new Beetle so much with the old Beetle, and they have very little awareness of the whole history of the car, its birth in the Third Reich. And really, the whole story of the Beetle has been this twist of ironies, a tragicomic moving in and out of the dark sides into the bright sides of culture. How you go from Himmler to Herbie, how you end up being a plush toy sold in the Disney Mall store after starting out as a detailed model given to Adolf Hitler on his birthday. It's just one of those very strange crystals that takes all of our history of the last century and throws it into many fascinating lights.
Well, Phil Patton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. This was fun.
Phil Patton is the author of the new book, Bug: The Strange Mutations of the World's Most Famous Automobile.